Welcome to Profit Boss Radio, where successful women have paved the road to their own financial freedom. Each week, your host, Hillary Hendershot, financial coach, money mindset expert, and experienced wealth manager, will help you discover the keys to the wealth and peace of mind you want and deserve in her no-nonsense and authentic style. Starting right now.
Profit Boss, just to be real with you, I'm recording this intro while baby Harlan sleeps. I don't have the nanny here today, and so it's mama baby time, and I slipped away because I've been thinking about you. Today we are talking about the power of brands, and this definitely applies to you, whether you're someone who's quickly climbing the corporate ladder or you're an entrepreneur who's building your business. Brand power is coveted. For example, no matter how you plan to vote in this presidential election, as we watch the campaign, you are essentially watching a battle of brands. You, for example, probably recall that Donald Trump's wife, Melania, was recently branded a plagiarist because parts of a speech that she gave were similar to a speech that Michelle Obama gave many years ago. But then from inside the Trump camp, a speechwriter took responsibility for the similarities in the speeches. So now we know that the Trump power couple does not want that reputation or brand resting on Melania's shoulders. There's another example of brand building. Bill Clinton recently declared his wife Hillary a changemaker. That's a perfect example of brand building. They are putting a stake in the ground and claiming that title or reputation. You can't deny the power of each of those candidates' brands in the election. So in this busy world, people will likely only remember you by the characteristics that you lead with. That's your brand. Whether you are corporate career-minded and climbing the ladder, building your own business brand, this absolutely correlates to your money. I am proud to introduce you today a woman who I consider my branding guru. I carefully followed her advice when I was designing my own company just a few years ago. I read her Branding for Basics book, and I also took an online course she was offering at that time, and I created something I'm super proud of with her help. Also, I'm introducing a new theme in the podcast today, and that is Everyday Heroines. Learning from finance and wealth building gurus is one thing for you, but I want you to be able to hear from people who are making it happen for themselves financially and aren't holding themselves out as money experts. These are the kinds of conversations I would wish for you to have in your wealth mastermind, so we're having them on the show. Since Maria and her husband are also financial planning clients of mine, I have seen and had the opportunity to be impressed with Maria's positive mindset, and she was generous enough to say that she'd allow me to transition the interview once we talked about branding, and that she'd be willing to share about her own financial life. So Maria Ross is our first Profit Boss Everyday Heroine. And of course, my lawyer has a few things to say about today's show. I think I should get my lawyer on the show because I quote him so often. So James, if you're listening, we love you, buddy. But please note that Maria is so kind to say nice things about me as a financial advisor during her interview. And you should not misconstrue her kind words about our relationship to be a testimonial for my investment services. That's yet another thing the government does not allow me to do is publish client testimonials for my investment services. And I do not do it. Without further legalese, allow me to introduce the lovely, lyrical, and multi-talented Maria Ross. Maria is a brand strategist. She's also an author and an amazing speaker. She believes cash flow and creativity are not mutually exclusive. Imagine. As a creator of Red Slice, she advises startups, solopreneurs, and small businesses on how to craft irresistible brands. She's the author of Branding for Basics for Small Business. That's how to create an irresistible brand on any budget. Pick up the second edition. And the newly launched ebook series, The Juicy Guides for Entrepreneurs, as well as her powerful personal memoir, Rebooting My Brain. She's a dynamic speaker, and she's delighted all kinds of audiences from the New York Times to the Chamber of Commerce and blog her. And she's appeared in and written for numerous media outlets, including MSNBC, ABC News, The Huffington Post, Forbes.com, NPR, and Entrepreneur Magazine. Maria lives in the San Francisco Bay Area with her husband, their toddler son, who is adorable, and their precocious black lab mix. Check out Momentum, Maria's 12-month guided program to master your marketing, build your brand, and save your sanity. Registration closes August 31st, 2016. I'll say it again during the interview, but to connect with Maria, just head over to today's show notes at hillaryhendershot.com/30. Let's do this.
Maria, welcome to Profit Boss Radio.
Thanks for having me, Hillary.
To give people some sense of the value of personal branding, let's talk about some people who have truly achieved a dominance of personal brand. The first person I came up with was Kim Kardashian. Good or bad, awesome. Lover or hater, she has a brand. And maybe because that's all she has, you know, her brand is really clear. Also, again, love him or hate him, Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Michelle Obama. Mm-hmm. Anyone whose personal brand you love, respect, or envy?
Mm-hmm. Actually, for me, I you know, I think probably a lot of people would say Oprah as well.
Ooh, yeah.
She sort of has the nirvana of a personal brand in that anything she touches turns to gold because of her halo effect of her brand. I think that that's kind of the holy grail of when you're looking at building a personal brand. Is it something that can not just say something about you, but the products or people or services or books that you endorse as well? I really admire her. And partly it's because I just admire her brand and what she stands for. So
there's even a whole phenomenon called the Oprah effect.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Brands that go on her show just make millions and millions afterward, right?
For sure. Yeah. For sure. I mean, and yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, part of that is also she just has built this really loyal following. And so whatever she says, they trust. There's a huge amount of trust. And that's one of the biggest components of building your brand is, does your audience trust you? And trust you in whatever way your brand represents. So you were talking about Donald Trump, you were talking about Kim Kardashian. Their fans trust them because they buy into their message. So even if us on the outside might not agree with their messages, the important thing is that their fans agree with their message. And so therefore, there's a lot of trust built up in, if I agree with your message, I'm also going to agree with things that you endorse and things that you recommend. That's what we're trying to get at when we build a personal brand for ourselves, for our business, for our cause, whatever it is that we're trying to persuade people about.
Mm-hmm. And Michelle Obama really made...
Oh, I love her.
Yes, I know. Put a foot forward as First Lady of the United States with her campaign to encourage healthy eating. And it's augmented by her being perceived as very compassionate, very generous, very kind. She kind of walks her talk. You know, mm-hmm. She's got like biceps and wears sleeveless dresses that the media loves to comment on.
Absolutely.
So it all goes together the way a good personal brand should.
Yeah, and absolutely. And, you know, she has an army of people who are very thoughtfully helping create that for her. I'm not saying that it's inauthentic, but they are definitely enhancing what's already there by design.
Really?
You know, as with all politicians, it's, you know, when they step into the office, especially First Lady, it's sort of like, what do you want your legacy to be? There's aides and consultants that help them with that. But that said, they have to have something there to work with. And that's where the authenticity comes in. Michelle Obama is all of those things. She's graceful. She's educated. She's eloquent. She's funny. I don't know if you've ever seen her on talk shows and things like that, but she's great. She embodies what a lot of women in this country want to be. And that's a very important brand, quote unquote, that the First Lady often tries to latch onto. And some First Ladies have been more successful than others. I think what's interesting is I would say that, and you know, maybe this is a controversial statement, but I would say that Michelle Obama is kind of one of the first modern women in the First Lady role where, and I don't know if it's just I'm closer to her age group than the past.
But I've been to First Ladies in the past.
Exactly. But I think that she represents kind of a shift and a modernism in not just the role of the First Lady, but where women are in this country. And she's a really good representative example of that.
So a lot of confluence of events there contributing to her personal brand. And obviously those personal brands have tremendous value to those people. I mean, you know, Donald Trump is his brand and it's gotten him onto the presidential election ticket. And then conversely, you have failures of personal branding. You have Tonya Harding, who was accused of commissioning a brutal attack on her competitor in the figure skating competition.
Who did, in fact, do those things.
Yes, she did. Yes, sorry.
Just accused. But yeah, and one of the more recent examples is Lance Armstrong. I've blogged about that spectacular brand fail. Because
the consummate liar.
I mean, it's just the height that he got to and the height that he fell from is just staggering. And, you know, being married to someone who's an avid cyclist, and Lance Armstrong was a hero to him, to like, he won't even watch anything having to do with Lance Armstrong anymore. Wow. Because it's just, which was really sad. It really impacted, for example, his charity. And they really had to be calculating and distancing themselves from him. Whereas before, they were latching on to the personal brand because it was helping them. And then when the scandal broke, it actually hurt them to a really big extent. So that's the risk that companies take or organizations take when they latch on to a personal brand. You know, you're latching on to a person, a human, and everything that goes with that,
a fallible human.
Yeah. All those people. And you do take that risk as a company when you try to align yourself with a personal brand, because it's really great when it's great, and then it's really bad when it's bad.
Others I came up with: Monica Lewinsky. 20 years after having an affair with the former president, she still says it's completely ruined her life. She wrote a book about the pain of being demonized by the media, Richard Nixon.
Yeah. And I don't know, kind of going back to Monica Lewinsky, she recently did a TED talk about that. Yep. I don't know if you've seen it, but it is amazing. It's all about this idea of public shaming being the new blood sport. And it's true.
The new gladiator games.
Yeah. It's, I think also reality TV hasn't helped the culture get beyond that. But yeah, it's amazing how, on the one hand, there's a school of thought, which I don't necessarily subscribe to, but a lot of people do, that says there's no such thing as bad publicity. And so one could argue, and some detractors of Monica Lewinsky have argued, that she only has a platform because of her scandal.
Right.
That she never would have had a platform to begin with if that scandal hadn't happened to her. So yes, it ruined her life. You know, it definitely did. No one's denying that. But also, she wouldn't be in the seat she's in today and able to have that platform where she can talk about those things had that experience not happened to her. So
yeah, I think in order to buy that argument, you'd kind of have to value platform over a lot of things.
Exactly. Exactly. and you have to sort of argue, it's kind of the, what's the phrase, like the means justify the end. And so if the person ends up doing something amazing with their life, then you say, oh, wow, that was the best thing that ever happened to them, was that they had this scandal. But yeah, I would argue that during that time when she was an early 20 something, you know, kid, which essentially she was. I mean, think about, you know, all the mistakes we've made with relationships in our past. I mean, I wouldn't ever want some of that coming to light, but she was living it splashed out on the front page. And what I loved about her TED talk, lover or hater, she was like, look, my story was, I was a young kid who fell in love with their boss.
Yeah.
Which is what it came right down to, right? So yeah, it's interesting how there's these brand fails, especially from a personal brand perspective. And there's some people that don't see that as bad at all. And then there's others who are like, yeah, there's definitely a price that was paid for that scandal or whatever it was that happened to the person to tear them down.
You couldn't really argue that these personal brands have impacted these folks' income potential. I mean, mm-hmm. Monica Lewinsky's life is completely altered. Tanya Harding's life is completely altered. Mm-hmm. Vis-a-vis someone like Kim Kardashian, who makes money only because of her personal brand.
Right. And the interesting thing is, you know, when you think of a personal brand like Kim Kardashian's, is there anything she can't do that would actually hurt her brand? I don't know, because she's already, you know, she's already had a sex tape. She's already, she's already done things that, for some personal,
I think the sex tape signal, was strategic, right?
I know, exactly. But that's what I'm saying, is some personal brands are constructed in a way that the more salacious and the more scandalous activities they engage in, it actually only furthers the brand. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing a little bit with Donald Trump, that it doesn't matter what outrageous thing he says, it's cementing the brand for the people that want to follow him. I don't think there's any misstep he could do at this point that's going to ruin that particular brand that he's creating for himself.
Yeah, it's an interesting sidebar. It's kind of like a spiral down, in the same way Oprah has a spiral up effect.
Yes.
You know, it doesn't matter what coal or junk he brings into his brand platform, it fits.
Right. And I think it's because it has to do with what is the brand. You know, if the brand is built on, you know, for example, Lance Armstrong, the reason why that fail was so spectacular is because he had a brand built on integrity, on
athleticism,
on honesty,
on competition.
Yeah. Good competition. You know, he was a strong competitor. And so if you do anything that goes against that, that's going to bring the brand down. If you have a brand built on conflict and inflammatory remarks and racism and whatever, you know, not to get political here, but if your brand is built on those things, then that behavior is only going to cement that brand.
Okay. And then to bring it home for the audience, you know, I'm sure you can think of people in your community and in your work environment who have a strong personal brand, even if they're not in the media, like Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So there's the guy who's always helping with your computer, or the gal, the vegan, right?
Right.
Or that person that is always looking to contribute something extra to the work product, and everyone says, oh, she's clearly on her way up. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
That's a brand.
Yeah. I think the one we all know, I think in all of our lives, we have that person. Who's the go-to person when you need a good restaurant or a good movie?
The connector.
Everybody's got that person in their life where it's like, oh my God, you should totally ask so-and-so. They're so on it. They know what's happening. They know what's hot, you know, and that's a personal brand. It's that person is in the know, trendy, always has their ears open to the latest and greatest. You know, we all have that person in our lives. So I think if that can help people bring home what we mean by a brand, it's what is that reputation or that impression that people have of you or of your business or of your book or of your cause or, you know, whatever it is, what is the impression and the mind share? What do people think of when they think of you?
Right. And you can create that consciously, or don't most people just inherit a brand?
True. I think that there's ways to amplify it though. And that's where the job of personal branding comes in, is that you're intentional and you're thoughtful. What I definitely want to make sure we communicate is that what doesn't work is manufacturing a brand. So when we talk about creating a brand, that kind of tends to turn people off a little bit. And, you know, the work that I do with clients, with companies, and with solopreneurs and entrepreneurs is more about, what do we have to work with? What's in our arsenal? What are our strengths? What are our interests? What are our passions? What are we already known for? Let's talk of those things and then be very intentional in the words and the actions and the visuals that we use so that we further cement that brand, and we make decisions that are thoughtful that will only serve to further the brand in the minds of the people that we're trying to influence.
Now that you've said all that, what exactly is a brand and how do people brand themselves effectively?
So like we talked about, a brand is really just, it's your core, it's your impression, it's your essence, it's what you
stand. Is it a mission statement or is it three things?
That's a manifestation of a brand. Okay. So you have to know what the brand is before you can write a mission statement communicating it. So just like someone has a personality, right? That personality comes through in the clothes that they wear. It comes through in the words that they say and how they talk. It comes through in the actions that they take. Where people get tripped up with brand is that they think the actions and the words and the visuals come first. You have to actually know what your brand is before you can determine how to best convey it to the world. And with a company, how you convey that is through your logo, through your colors, through your website, through your copy, through your social media posts, all of those things. But those are merely tactics that are communicating a deeper brand strategy. So the work that I do with clients is helping them figure out what that brand strategy actually is. And then you can go forth and communicate it in various channels.
Are there actual rules to branding that are agreed upon? Is there a branding Bible, or is it more art than science?
I think it's kind of a mix of art and science. I would say from the science perspective, loosely using that term, I mean, there are certain rules, like you should be consistent. Otherwise, you're going to confuse people. You should be clear. You should be focused. A big thing about branding is you cannot appeal to everybody, whether you're a company, whether you're a person, whether you're a media personality. There's no way to be all things to all people, because otherwise you end up being nothing to no one. So you really have to be clear on, this is what I stand for. This is my value. This is what I want to be known for. And these are the types of people I'm trying to attract or influence or connect with. So as an example, and I use this one all the time, Miley Cyrus has a brand, right? I'm not a fan of Miley Cyrus, and Miley Cyrus doesn't care that I'm not a fan, because I'm not the person that she's talking to. If she was to get all concerned with trying to appeal to people like me, then she'd end up being nothing to the people that are actually her most loyal fans. So sometimes you have to be comfortable with the fact that if you have a strong brand, just like a Kim Kardashian, just like a Donald Trump, there are people who will not like you. And that's okay, because that means that you are speaking to a very specific audience, and your message is resonating and connecting with them without being diluted.
Because you have to polarize a little bit.
You do have to polarize a little bit. I mean, you don't have to offend
Right. No, you don't have to offend.
But it's getting comfortable. I work with small business owners all the time who are, you know, but if I do this, then I'm going to offend this. And if I speak like this, then I'm going to offend that. And it's like, you've got to put a stake in the ground and say, this is my tribe and I'm going to be loyal to them first and foremost. And other people will get caught in that net, even though you're not quote unquote targeting them, but you can't be concerned with all the people that may not like you. And the most successful companies in the world know that. And they're very clear on not trying to convince everybody that needs what they offer that they are the right fit for them. They just want to be concerned with the people that they are the right fit for.
And so in that sense, the brand is closely related to the niche, or maybe the niche makes the brand self-evident.
The niche is part of the brand. So the brand strategy encompasses a lot of different things. And one of them is, who am I talking to? Mm-hmm. Who's my audience? That's one aspect of your brand strategy. The other is, you know, what are my strengths? What is my value that I offer? What am I going to hang my hat on in terms of benefits? So for example, you're a financial planner, right? How are you different from other financial planners? You're going to put a stake in the ground and say, I'm different because I have these philosophies. I take these approaches. I work with these types of clients. I speak in this manner, you know, however you choose. And yes, those are the things that are making you effective for your niche.
Yes. And I really clearly have, as evidenced by in this podcast, whenever I speak to my audience, first I call them profit bosses, but I always talk about women, and there are plenty of men that listen to the show.
For sure.
But I've chosen to focus on that niche market.
Almost. Exactly.
Not and that half the population is a niche, but.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you don't want to pick a niche of like three people in the world. I mean, that's not good for business. But yeah, it's being very clear that the reason that it's easier to make marketing decisions and invest your time and your money and your energy in which ones to choose, it's based on who you're talking to. And so exactly what you just said, if other people resonate with your message, great, you know, get on the bus, like come with us. You're part of our tribe. It doesn't mean you're going to alienate them, but you're being very clear and intentional with your message and with where you're going to put your marketing dollars trying to attract people.
Okay. So this is a great segue. And I feel like we're towing the line on the difference between personal brand and business brand. So you're a perfect example. Do you consciously think about your personal brand, or are you focused primarily on the platform that is the Red Slice brand?
Well, I might be in a situation that a lot of your listeners are in that my business is me.
Yeah.
I'm a solopreneur, what they call a solopreneur, a solo entrepreneur. I do not want to build an agency and hire people and sell it off and have it live beyond me. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm building a business around my consulting capabilities and my writing. So for me, the line is very blurred in that everything my business does is me and everything that I do is my business. So the business was built reflecting my values, my work style, my writing style, the clients that I chose to serve because they were the people I enjoyed working with, you know, that sort of thing. So for me, it's a little bit different. I think if someone listening is running a business and it's a little bit broader than just their own personal likes and passions, you can still build a business based on your values. Those can become cornerstones of the actual brand of the business. How the business chooses to do business and treat the customer could be an output of how you personally feel about those things, right? You can sort of embed that into the culture of your company and into the brand of your company. But for me, it's a decision. I mean, are there aspects of myself that I don't bring into my quote unquote business? Absolutely. But I would say there's probably a 95% overlap. I'm not presenting something in social media or online or whatever that is going to be completely different from when they interact with me in person. And I think that's an important thing. If anyone's a service professional, especially, those things should be very consistent. We talked about rules earlier. Uh-huh. You have to be consistent with your brand across every touch point, because otherwise you confuse people. And then they're like, I don't know. I don't get you. Like, I don't get what you're about. I don't get your vibe. I don't get the value you offer. Like, over here, you're one thing, and over here, it's another. And I talk to a salesperson from your company and I get a completely different elevator pitch than if I talk to this person over here. Inconsistency will drive people to your competitors.
Yes.
Because people don't have time to figure you out.
And so not their job.
It's not their job. And it takes, you know, it's not like you touch somebody once with your message and bam, they convert to a client or convert to a customer. You have to have several times that your message and you are in front of them. And if those messages are different every single time. You're starting from zero. You get no memorability. You get no repeatability because they're like confused at that point. So yeah, I think for my business, it is, it's intentional in an unintentional way, if that makes sense.
No, you lost me. Are you saying branding is in your soul and you can't help not do it?
No, I'm not. I'm not saying that, but that's cool. I should use that. So what I mean by that is that the nature of my business dictates that my brand is me and I am my brand. They're not kind of two separate things because of the way I've chosen to structure my business. When people work with me, they're just working with me.
Yes.
So my personality, my work style, my beliefs, my values, and how I operate are the brand of my company. I could very easily call my company Maria Ross Inc. and it'd be the same thing.
Right.
So I think it just depends on the type of business that you run. Of course, all businesses start out with a founder, right? Even some of the biggest businesses, Nordstrom, you know, is named after Nordstrom, and Sears is named after Sears. And, but, you know, so those businesses start out with the culture and the values and the mindset of the founder, but eventually those things are embedded into the culture and brand of the company. So they become the operating standard of the company, not just the operating standard or the brand of individual that started the company.
Yes. And for those of you who are listening who are maybe corporate employees, a way I think, well, Maria, please tell me if I'm right here. I think a way to think about this is managing your brand such that the brand values that you choose and manifest and demonstrate over time are aligned with the overall culture of the corporation or industry that you're working in, so that it's something that fits and something that makes people look to you and choose you over time, whether that's entrepreneurialism or technical expertise or things like that.
You're spot on. I think that, you know, there obviously when you work for a corporation, your brand is not the brand of the corporation. You know, somebody that works for Oracle is not necessarily the Oracle brand. However, you are representing the Oracle brand when you are out in the world, right? So you kind of need to be conscious of that as well. Mm-hmm. But your point is completely where it's at. You need to be really clear on what your brand is and your values, and make sure that you're working for a company that it's not in complete opposition to what you stand for. You know, let's use startups, tech startups as a perfect example. There's definitely a vibe and a culture with tech startups. They're, you know, fast paced. Mm-hmm. They're often flat organizations, very unpredictable, very long hours, all that kind of stuff. If that's not what you're about, then you should not be working for an organization like that. So you can take that example and extrapolate it out to any brand of a large company. If what that company does and says and how they act in the marketplace doesn't jive with your personal values and who you are, you're not going to be happy there.
That's actually a perfect way to describe what went wrong with my final last corporate gig. And getting back to the error of mixed branding, a perfect example happened to me today. Someone actually pitched to be on Profit Boss Radio, and he sent a PDF describing himself as a financial expert, but his pitch was about helping business owners get more money out of their business, which I love. He also says he wants to talk about investing for women and that he's a certified financial planner. So I'm left like, who is this person? I have no idea what you want to talk about. There's not a quote or anything on the one sheet. And he says he's been quoted in the Wall Street Journal. So I Google his name and the Wall Street Journal and nothing comes up and I'm done. It's not my job to do more research on this person. I love to say yes. I love that he likes the show, but I have brand confusion.
Absolutely. And I think it's that inconsistency. And, you know, what a lot of my clients say is like, but I am all these things, like, or I can offer all these services. And why can't I talk about them all? Like, that's great. There's things that you can offer, but you sort of have to have, what's the marquee, right? With everyone's short attention span in today's world, with how crowded the marketplace is, with how noisy it is, you can't be known for 20 different things because it's just confusing. So I call it, what are you going to hang your hat on?
Yes.
So in this example, you know, what are the top two or three things this guy is about? And then maybe as he works with a client, he can fold in other offerings, and that's great. But what are you going to lead with? What's your lead offer? Because that's right away, people can make sense of you. They can go, yeah, you're for me. Or no, I'm sorry, you're not for me. And everyone can move on. And I think that that's the mistake is people just want it. Well, I want to try to grab everybody. So I'm going to say I do these 20 different things. And you end up just being really diluted. Like, this is a great example that recently I've realized. Someone was talking to me about hairstylists. Someone was telling me that someone was a really good hairstylist, right? And that's great. There's a lot of really good hairstylists out there. However, what I'm interested in is someone who's a really good hairstylist specifically with curly hair.
I knew you were going to say that.
Right? Yes. Right? Because there's a difference.
There's a big difference.
That's what I need. So it doesn't mean that the good hairstylist, it just means I'm going to be more attracted to somebody that's saying they're a good hairstylist with curly haired people than someone who just says, I'm a good hairstylist. And that's what we mean by specificity. My hairstylist actually does a lot of people with straight hair, but it doesn't mean she's limiting her clientele to curly haired people, but she's building a reputation as, hey, if you need a good hairstylist and you have curly hair, this is the person you're going to go to. And by nature, we're going to go to the person that is more specifically speaking to our needs than someone who's just more broadly speaking to our needs. Another example would be if you talk about targeting busy people versus busy moms, right? If you are a busy mom, which, let's say, life coach is going to resonate more with you? Someone that helps busy people or somebody that helps busy moms?
Oh, clearly.
So yeah, it's about that clarity. But yet the busy mom life coach, it doesn't mean she can never take on a client that's not a mom. It just means that's the reputation that she's choosing to put the stake in the ground on and say, yeah, I want to be known for this.
And when Oprah started, all she was doing was interviewing people on television. She didn't have any of the other assets or gigs or shows or the magazine, none of that. It all spun out of years and years of sitting on that couch.
Right, right.
Interviewing people. Well,
and the great example that Oprah gives us is that if you are really thoughtful and consistent in the brand that you build, you can extend that brand. So she didn't just build a brand around, I'm a TV interviewer, right? The brand she built was around more than that. It was about her philanthropy. It was about her generosity. It was about her community involvement. It was about all these other things. So she was able to expand to, well, what other types of things could I do with this brand? Oh, I can start a foundation. Oh, I can have a magazine. Oh, I can do this. I think that's where we get to your mission statement, right? Your mission statement should be irrespective of the avenue you choose to make your living in, if that makes sense. Because if you have a mission statement that guides your brand that's a little broader, then you can actually figure out, well, what are the different ways I can accomplish that mission? So for example, you know, a financial planner, you know, if you're all about helping people make sense of their money, that's your mission. Then you can do that through teaching. You can do that through financial planning. You can do that through being a media personality. You can do that through writing a book. So I think where people get tripped up is they try to make their brand mission, their strategy based on specifically what they're doing right now versus something deeper that, hey, can I extend this and can this have legs and can this take other forms?
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. So do you mind giving us some examples of the brand values that you've selected for your firm and the things that you do to perpetuate those brand values in your customers' eyes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of my biggest values, for me, it kind of mixes between values and sort of like how I work. But one of the biggest ones is I strongly believe in tough love. So if someone wants to be coddled and to be told that everything they're doing is absolutely amazing, they should not work with me. That said, I'm very supportive, but I don't believe I'm doing anyone any favors with the money that they're paying me if I just yes them to death. Now, I'm sure they could find other brand strategists or other marketing consultants that could just say, oh my God, your plan is the most brilliant thing I've ever seen. And I think it's totally going to succeed and it's going to help you build a 7-figure business. Like, I'm not that girl. Like, mm-hmm. I am going to tell you where you need to push yourself. I am going to tell you where something needs improvement. I'm going to do it with love and I'm going to do it with constructive criticism, but that's why I call it sort of a tough love philosophy. So with my clients often up front in our sessions, I have to say, I'm just going to tell you this right now. Please don't be offended. If I push back on you and I challenge you and I kind of probe a little bit and make you rethink things, because that's what you need and that's what you're paying me for. And because I'm very clear about that's the way I operate, because that's the voice I take in my blog. That's the voice I take in my emails and in my social media posts. And when I do public speaking, people know that up front. So if someone doesn't want that, they're not even going to bother contacting me.
Right.
And that's okay, because I wouldn't enjoy working with someone like that anyway. So that's what I mean by, it's almost like your brand can be a little bit of your gatekeeper, your bouncer that kind of helps people, this sounds bad, but keep people out that you're not going to really enjoy working with and that aren't going to enjoy working with you, but then also can attract and let in the people that, yeah, this person's totally for me. Some of my other values are, with great reward comes great responsibility. I really advocate philanthropy in a lot of what I speak about and what I do. I try to encourage any brands I'm working with to find some way to have a philanthropic bent to their brand. If something meshes really well, where there's a charity they could align with, or they could promote themselves as doing good in the community, I'm always going to push for that, because I feel like that's a responsibility that, as a company does well, if they can give back to the community and give back to the world, even if it's just I'm working on someone with their personal brand, can we make that part of what you do and what your mission is, and make you money at the same time? I really believe that passion and profit can coexist nicely. but the other, you know, it's really funny because mine have shifted as I've gotten older and as I've had a child. One of my biggest tenets used to be work hard, play hard. That served me well all through college, all through my early career. I mean, that was how I did things. And in recent years, that's actually shifted for me. And I'm more about being present and about taking on what you can handle and doing things in moderation, whether it's managing your schedule and making sure you're not overcommitted to, you know, whatever it is. I can't think of another example there, but it's interesting that that was a strong brand value for me initially, and that has evolved. So your brand can and should evolve as you evolve and grow, as your company evolves and grows, as the market, as your customers' needs evolve and grow. A brand doesn't have to be necessarily something that's completely static and is going to live in its exact same form for 30, 40, 50 years.
And what are some ways that you've seen business owners communicate their brand values really effectively? I know one everybody's talking about right now is the Dove soap campaign for real beauty, which has nothing to do with soap. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's beautiful and it's inspiring and it brings tears to people's eyes. If you haven't seen the video, I don't know if you have a particular reaction to that one or other examples that you champion and love.
Examples of people manifesting their brand values out in the marketplace. Is that
exactly
what you're saying?
Exactly.
Yeah. I've seen quite a few. Another one that comes to mind just from specifically a product has been Dawn dishwashing soap. So they've really latched onto this message of, I actually have never actually fact checked this to see if it's true. I'm assuming it is, but okay. They have advertising out there that talks about the fact that they are used to clean animals who are affected by oil spills, that they're using Dawn soap to actually take the grease off these little adorable furry little animals and ducklings and seals and whatever. So they really have a huge mission, and they're actually amping up that message in the market because it's helping them stand out from other dishwashing soap. So they have a philanthropic initiative where they're giving money back, you know, with every purchase. It benefits a wildlife organization. And I just think that's really neat because, you know, how much can you differentiate dishwashing soap?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? So, you know, that's what's really great. It's like, it's a philanthropic angle that not only helps their profits, but it helps a cause. Like, why not do that? If you can do both, why not do that? I worked at Discovery Networks years ago, you know, to the Discovery Channel, TLC, and I was a marketing manager there. And a lot of what we do to benefit the cable companies was to do local community events, like refilling local food banks or stuff like that. And I thought, well, that's great. Like, the cable company gets a great little PR, you know, oh, look at all the great good they're doing in the community. But more important, the food bank gets filled up. Like, that solves everybody's problem, right? So I love when I see brands being able to, are they getting personal gain out of it? Is it completely altruistic? Probably not. But who cares if the cause or the organization that they're benefiting benefits from that? That's kind of how I feel when I talk about the great rewards mean you have a great responsibility.
I do think that's kind of the currency of the day, is how are you contributing to the larger society, and how are you giving back, and how are you making a difference? And I love that, because it is our responsibility, and not to push it off on the government to do it for us.
Right. And I think it's also the reason why it's so, you know, I've always felt this way, but it's sort of in vogue now, is because that's what millennials care about. And if you're trying to attract millennials, you better have a deeper mission and purpose, or they will not give you the time of day. They're very service minded. So it's about your cause. It's about your purpose. It's about what you do to give back to the community or world that they're attracted to. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's been, you know, I can't cite specific research on that, but there's been a lot of research about that out in the kind of marketing marketplace. But the other example that and why am I thinking of like dishwashing soaps? But this is really bad. But
I don't know. But we did Dove soap and dishwashing soap.
Yeah, there's actually another brand called Method. They make cleaning products, which you may be familiar with.
I own a couple.
Yeah. And they're not only sort of ecologically responsible, but they are also very quirky. They've created a very quirky, approachable, I want to say bubbly, but that's because I'm thinking of soap right now, personality for themselves that's manifested in every touch point, from even just how their logo looks to the bright, lively colors that they use in their products, to if you've ever actually read their packaging, it's full of little one-liners and little like, hey, just saying hi, or hey, like just all these little whimsical surprises whenever you keep looking. And that's what consistency looks like, right? That's saying we are going to think intentionally about every single thing our customer might see or hear or read or look at. And we're going to make sure that it's communicating our brand. And that is something that, you know, is really easy for a small business because they're sort of managing everything themselves to think about and say, my autoresponder on my email signup form, does it convey my brand?
Right.
Does my voicemail message on my office phone or shop phone convey something about my brand other than, hi, thanks for calling. Here are our hours. Please leave a message. You know, that sort of thing. So the more that you can sort of put those little surprises in. But the only reason you know what to do is if you've got the strong brand strategy in the first place to say, this is what we're trying to convey. And this is who we're talking to.
Okay. So how do you recover from a branding fail?
If I had the secret formula for that, I'd go into sort of PR crisis. But I think there's been some companies that have shown us how they've responded. I mean, one of my marks, I sort of have five marks of a power brand. And one of them is that you can recover elegantly from your mistakes. And that has to do with being transparent and acting quickly. So one of the examples I've used in conference speeches that I've made is JetBlue. So many years ago, you know, they built this reputation on being friendly, being sort of the anti-airline, being different from the other guys, and their service was great. And they were all about, you know, making the flying experience suck less and, you know, all of that. And then a few years ago, there was this horrific storm on the East Coast as there, you know, I feel like we could be talking about any year on the East Coast recently, but it was several years ago. And a bunch of their planes just got stranded on the tarmac, and it was a PR nightmare because they built their brand on service, on friendliness, on how they handled things, whatever. How they recovered from that was what made the difference to keeping their brand alive and well. And it was, you know, A, they let people know what was going on immediately. They got executives out to the airports to do everything from check baggage to whatever else needed to be done. They did whatever it took to try to make their customers happy in this situation that honestly they couldn't control. And they were just very transparent and authentic about it. Like, we know this was horrible. Here's the update. You know, they gave updates. They weren't hiding behind anything or trying to put a gloss over it in that, well, no, it's the weather. There's nothing we could do, right? I mean, they very easily could have taken that stance and they didn't. And that is why their brand recovered. And because they had so much brand goodwill built up in the first place, they were able to recover a little bit more elegantly. So I think when there is a brand fail, A, it kind of depends on what kind of a brand fail it is, but B, it's about getting ahead of it, being transparent, being authentic, making things right. You know, all the things that you should do as a person when you make a mistake.
I was going to say that. Yeah. It's like apologizing for blowing it with your friend, or, you know, it's like, okay.
Right. And above the apology, you know, that's kind of the thing, is like, well, you can't just say you're sorry anymore, because that's kind of the, you know, the default. But what are you going to do about it?
Right.
You know, how are you going to remedy the situation? How are you going to build the trust back up? What are you going to do to change your behavior as a company or as a person? You know, where Lance Armstrong is so interesting, and I actually don't know if it's sort of some condition he has or something, but he still truly believes that he was in the right with what happened. He
it's
just
a
like
condition have, called narcissism.
Yes, well, that's what I mean. Like, I'm not in a position to diagnose
right.
that.
Neither of us are.
If I were a gambling woman, that's what I would say. But yeah, I mean, it's he just continued to fight it at every turn. And it was like, no, everyone's doing this. It's not cheating if everyone's doing it. You know, and people were just like, what? You're insane. You know what I mean? So, you know, even if you saw, actually, speaking of Oprah, the Oprah interview with him, it was just like, are you kidding me? Like you're just watching this guy. And even if you were rooting for him, even if you were like, look, I just want to hear he got seduced by this and the competitive nature took over and he knows it was wrong and he's not advocating, you know, all these young kids that are looking up to him as a hero. And he was like, no, I'd do it again. You know, I mean, he didn't say those words, but just the defensiveness and the justification for the bad behavior didn't help his brand at all. Right. Let's just put it that way. So be transparent, be authentic, give information, admit your mistake, take action to correct. You know, all of those things are great ways to recover from a brand fail.
I was actually going to transition to a different kind of question, but you said you have 5 marks of a power brand.
I do.
Would you share with us the other 4?
I will.
So the first one was the ability to recover from a brand fail or the ability to be transparent.
If you have a power brand, you know, people say like, what does it look like if I have a power brand and I have a really successful brand? One of the marks of that is that you can elegantly recover from mistakes, and you do elegantly recover from mistakes. So that's the JetBlue example that we were just talking about. Some of the other signs are kind of an obvious one, but people are proud to work, partner, or shop with you. So, you know, all those companies where people do not care about paying them money and then wearing a logo on their shirt or on their bag or on their purse because the brand says something about them, right?
Yes.
So, or you think of Apple, where companies are clamoring to partner with Apple and be aligned and sort of enjoy that brand halo effect. So that's how you know if you have a power brand. Are people clamoring to align themselves with you? Are they proud to work with you and shop with you? A second one is that, or third one, I guess, is customers spreading your story for you. So in time, a brand where people are actually, without being paid, become your best salespeople, you know, your customers become your best salespeople. That's the mark of a power brand. So the best example of this is Harley Davidson, where their customers feel so passionately about the brand that they literally tattoo their bodies with the company's logo. Can you think of a company that you would actually tattoo their logo on your body?
Only my own.
Your own. Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, if customers are spreading that story for you, you know, Virgin America is another good example that happy customers on their flights created, without Virgin asking them to, created videos of their experiences and posted them on YouTube. That's powerful. I mean, that is a brand that people love. So that's a really good mark of a power brand. Uh-huh. Something we were talking about earlier is the fourth mark, which is some people don't like you. So that's when we were talking earlier about you can't please everybody. If you've got a strong brand, there's going to be people that don't resonate with you and they don't get it, or they're just not attracted to that message, or they don't need what you've got, or whatever it is. And a really good example of this is Starbucks. So I lived in Seattle for a few years in between living in the Bay Area, and, you know, talk about a rabid coffee culture up there. And right. Starbucks is based up there. But, you know, you can get in the conversation with people where they just think Starbucks is the devil incarnate. They're ruining independent coffee shops. They're mass market. They're, you know, tasteless, blah, 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 whatever. And that's all well and good, but Starbucks doesn't care about those people. And not in a bad way, but it's just not where they're going to choose to focus their energy, right? Because they're going to focus their energy on the people that what Starbucks has to offer resonates with them. So I love Starbucks, not because it's the best coffee in the world, but because most of the time I get a consistent experience, no matter which Starbucks I go to. And I'm looking for consistency and speed. I'm not looking to wait a half an hour for my filtered
custom drip coffee.
Exactly. Which is great. Like if I had the time every day, I would maybe do that, but that's not the benefit that I'm seeking when I choose to go to Starbucks. So again, Starbucks is not going to spend all this money in marketing and education trying to convince those independent coffee passionistas.
Pursuers, yes.
But yeah.
Connoisseurs.
Connoisseurs, exactly. They're like, great, then go to your independent coffee shop. We're doing fine over here with our mass market.
Right.
And then finally, the press talks about your impact on the industry and on the world beyond what you actually sell. So, you know, are you getting quoted in the press about topics related to your field or your industry, not just the services that you provide? Zappos is a great example. Tony Hsieh, the CEO, is now an expert on online customer satisfaction, which has nothing to do. I mean, it has something to do with Zappos's business model, but people are looking to him as an expert in that field versus just an expert in selling shoes and accessories on the internet. So that's a really good sign of a power brand, is if people are looking to your company sort of as a leader and as a bellwether in a certain industry.
That's fantastic. And in every example we've given of a branding win, I may not articulate this right the first time, but it's like there's this bigger picture phenomenon happening, right? There's just Zappos, which started just shoes, but there's online customer satisfaction, which is huge. It's altered my life, right? Or Oprah, and it being bigger than interviewing people from the couch on a television show. It's the philanthropy and the feel good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that kind of coming back full circle again to what we were talking about earlier, I think that that's why it's so important to have a mission that's beyond just the products and services that you sell right now. If you can build a brand and a reputation and an impression that transcends the products and services that you sell, you can change that mix over time, right? And you can still stand for something and you can find different channels to offer that to the world.
This has been great. I'm glad I asked about the five marks of a power brand. That was awesome. That's definitely aspirational.
Yeah. And I can add, I'd like to add something really quick about that, because I think a lot of people listening might, again, have small businesses or their own business and think, oh, I can, but you can have a power brand if you're a business of one. You know, it just depends on, are you doing all those things? You know, are people proud to align themselves with you? Do they talk about you and refer business? You know, are you transparent in your mistakes? Are there people that don't like you? You know, do you have an impact on the industry or on the world in terms of being quoted in the press or being interviewed for things? You know, so I think even if you are a business of one, you can show these signs of a power brand. Just you might be doing it at a different level.
Right. Great. And then as a business owner, as a human being, considering investing in any kind of endeavor, you have to think about ROI. How can we communicate to the audience how to think about, if not measure, the return on investment for the expense of branding efforts?
Well, I think it's very important to distinguish between direct marketing and branding. Mm-hmm. So direct marketing is I spend some money and then I calculate a cost per lead or cost per sale, right? Right. You don't do that with branding, because it'd be just like trying to assess a human being, like how do you get an ROI on their personality or on their reputation?
Very difficult.
Right. But what you can do is that you need to at least know you're going in the right direction. Because I always like to say, and having worked in both lead generation, direct marketing, and higher level branding world, I can say with absolute confidence that if you have a strong brand, it's actually the air cover to make your direct marketing more effective. So think about it this way. When you get something in your inbox from a brand that you love and you recognize, you're going to pay more attention to it, right? Than if you get something in your inbox from someone you've never heard of or something you don't understand. So you're going to be more likely to not only open the email, but act on it if there's a strong brand behind it. And that's what I mean by brand being the air cover, so that when you're ready to do direct marketing, when you're ready to ask for the sale, when you have a product or service that's on promotion and you want people to buy it within a limited amount of time, you've earned the right to get their attention because you've built a brand over time. So the brand building process doesn't happen overnight. It has to be consistent and clear, just like getting to know a person. You have to get to know a company and you have to learn how to know, like, and trust them. Mm. But the payoff is then when you are ready to ask for the sale, when you are ready to do direct marketing, when you're ready to have an event, you know, if you're an author building a personal brand, when you're ready to release your next book, the audience is going to be primed for converting on what you have to offer. And that's the value of brand, is that the direct marketing and the stuff that you actually measure the ROI on, it becomes more effective and the numbers get higher because you have a brand that stands behind those tactics and those efforts. That said, you can also measure that your brand is going in the right direction with things like, you know, number of new newsletter signups you get or number of visits to your site. There's sort of little markers along the journey of brand building that will let you know if you're going in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Do you get more people reading your blog? Do you have more newsletter signups? Do you have more people coming to your events, even if they might not buy anything at that, you know, or attending your webinars or listening to your podcast? Are those numbers going up at a good clip? In which case you'll know that you have the right trajectory. And then of course, branding is also very subjective. And so what's the anecdotal information you're getting? You know, are you noticing an increase in referral business? Well, then that means your brand is taking root, right? People are resonating with what you're saying and the value that you provide. And they're going, yeah, I'm going to recommend you to other people. So you want to have sort of a mix of those brand metrics and you have to track them. It's more the trajectory of those that you have to track over time to make sure that you're moving in the right direction. And ultimately those lead to sales. But if you're looking at brand in terms of an ROI on this is what I'm spending for my website, how much money did I bring in sales this month? You're looking at the wrong correlation.
If there were a timeline about branding spend, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, it seems like the branding spend should look a little bit more like a barbell. It's worth investing in the beginning, and then you have like a maintenance spend. And then probably as your brand evolves, you do like lumpy spending on branding, like maybe you need a rebrand or a brand refresh or something like that. But it's foundational.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And I think a lot of the upfront stuff doesn't even have to cost you anything. It just requires you to sit down and put together the strategy. And once you're clear on that, then you can invest in the tactics. But yeah, you're right. There's foundational things that you need to do that help convey your brand. So you do need a website. You might or might not need a logo. Have a design look and feel. You're probably going to want to, depending on what you do, if you've got products or services, you know, are you going to spend that on networking groups or joining networking associations? Are you going to spend that on joining trade associations? Are you going to spend that on, you know, a PR person to pitch your message? So yeah, I think it's fair to say that it is a little bit of a barbell, and not to get the development of a brand strategy confused with the tactics that you have to spend money on to convey that brand. I think if people are very clear in their head that once you actually put the brand strategy in place, and yes, you might spend money with a person like me to help you put that together, or some people, you know, can do it themselves. Mm-hmm. When you do that, you actually end up saving money later on, because what happens is everyone gets all caught up in, I need my website, I need a Facebook page, and they go out guns blazing trying to do the tactics first without a clear strategy in place. And all that yields is wasted effort and wasted investment, because you could be saying the wrong thing to the wrong people at the wrong time. And I wish I had some way to monetize all the calls I've gotten over the last 8 years of people that by the time they find me, they've already spent tens of thousands of dollars with a website designer or a logo developer or somebody like that. And it was completely wrong. And it was because they didn't spend the time or the money up front to put together the brand strategy. So of course they hired this person and didn't have a map for this person to follow. And so it, you know, led them nowhere. So I think that's the important thing is that, yeah, there's going to be some upfront spending and upfront time, more importantly, but that is going to yield ROI as you go along, because it's going to save you time and money, and your efforts are going to actually work. You're not going to have to make a mistake, start over and redo. You know, make another costly mistake, start over and redo. It doesn't mean you're never going to make a mistake when you have a brand strategy in place. It just means, you know, again, just like getting in the car, it's if you can get your brand strategy before you start driving, you know, if you punch in the destination into your GPS before you start driving, you have a better chance of getting there the right way.
It is difficult to get where you're going if you don't have an address to arrive at.
Yeah. And the address is not, oh, I already know what my brand strategy is. My brand strategy is I need a website. No, that's not a brand strategy.
See, even I know that.
Exactly. And I've heard that. I've heard that, like, I already have a brand strategy. I already have a logo. Like,
oh.
No, you don't.
Oh. No, that's not it. You know, and then the brand strategy or formation of it informs all the little particles and tactics that you do over time. And that turns into a kind of a robust library of brand touches, everything from the voicemail greeting to the signature line to the autoresponder text, like that.
Absolutely. It informs everything you do. And it informs not only what I would consider things in your marketing plan, you know, the actual tactics you're going to take. It informs so much more about your business as well. It informs who you hire, the type of people that you hire, your recruiting process, mm-hmm. you know, because brand is very closely linked to culture. So if you have not defined and articulated your brand, how do you know what kind of culture you're creating? And if you're not really sure what kind of culture you're creating or what you're trying to represent to the marketplace, how are you supposed to hire the right people to represent that brand? So exactly. It can inform hiring, and it can inform employee retention. It can inform your policies and procedures, both internally and externally, with, you know, what is our brand? A really great example is I had the opportunity to tour Airbnb a few months ago, behind the scenes with some of their executives talking about innovation and talking about culture. And their brand is so intertwined with their culture. Once they defined their brand direction, it informed everything from how they laid out and decorated their office space to what they evaluate on their employees' performance reviews, to how they recruit people, just everything. It's the core and essence of their company, and it informs customer relations, it informs advertising, it informs marketing, it informs office layout, if that's a department, you know, facilities. it informs production, it informs, you know, HR, everything. And that's how it should be.
That's great. Is there more, Maria, that we should cover on branding right now, or can I transition to a more personal interview?
We can absolutely transition.
Okay, great. Thank you for being my resident branding expert. You are extremely articulate. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then before, when we scheduled this interview and I asked you for permission to make part of this a more personal interview, basically because I know you, you're a client, and I think you have, maybe even unbeknownst to you, created something that many women would love to have or it would behoove to have. And I love the idea of women sitting around the fire or sitting around the bar talking shop about money. And what I know about you is that as long as I've known you, you've had a financially empowered mindset. And you've always been really confident and clear that you're going to take the right steps for your financial future. And the actuality of your life hasn't been the same. The household income has gone up and gone down, and you've bought real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area. And but it's like the mindset, as far as I can tell, the mindset stays consistent. And that's something that really hinders so many people. So can I start by asking you where you got that financial vision?
Well, first, I love you because I don't, maybe there's stuff about my past you don't know. No, just kidding. But thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. I think and I've gone through everything. I mean, and you've been very candid with stories about your kind of financial past, you know, and I got into a period during the first tech downturn in 99 where I had credit card bills of $30,000 to $40,000. I was basically living off my credit cards because I went through three different layoffs of startups that hired and then fired people, hired and laid off as they, you know, gained and lost money. So, you know, that was a really dark time for me. But I think number one, I always sort of had an abundance mindset that somehow things would work out or I would figure out a way for things to work out. And
do you know where you got that?
Well, I think that part of it, my parents are older. They had me in their 40s, and my mom actually just recently passed away. But they, from as long as I can remember, they were always saving for retirement. And because they were older, I mean, their retirement, my dad retired my senior year of college and actually hid it from me for a couple of months. I was studying abroad and he got the opportunity to do early retirement because his company was going through restructuring and he took it, and they didn't tell me till I got back because they didn't want me to worry. So since I was a senior in high school, my parents have been retired. You know, and my dad's still alive, and I'm not a senior in high school anymore. Or sorry, a senior in college, I should say. So, you know, I mean, that's been a long time. My parents have been living off retirement income. And so, you know, they always were thinking about retirement. They were always thinking about, you know, I remember back in the day, the insurance agent would come to the house and meet with you in the evening and go through your plan. You know, I remember all that when I was a kid, that planning was taking place. And even though we sort of had a modest middle class upbringing in New York, we always went on family vacations. We had a second home further out east on Long Island that was a little bungalow, but it was like our summer house. And, you know, which my parents bought for like $20,000 or something back in the day. But my family had a second home, even though it's not like glamorous Hampton's second home. But, you know, we always had these things. So there was always enough.
Yeah.
That was there. And we didn't live extravagantly. We took our family vacations and we had our holidays and our whatever. But I grew up in that environment. So I think I grew up very cognizant that people retire and have to live off their retirement savings. So from my very first job, I was 21 when I graduated from college, and my first job was as a management consultant. I started contributing to my 401k, like the second paycheck, because I got scared. Like, I was like, well, my parents are living off their retirement. Someday I might have to live off my retirement. So There were some periods when I switched jobs that a couple months went by without me contributing to my 401k that I actually used to panic about because I thought I'm losing this month. I'm losing this month, blah, 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 you know, cause I hadn't set something up. But so I think that's where it comes from. For me, money is security. It's stability. It's the ability to be able to do the things you want to do. I love traveling. I love eating out. I love wine. All of those things take money. And so
not $2 Chuck.
No, although that, you know, sometimes that hits the spot, but you know, whatever. But I'm sorry. Yeah. And I'm sorry to ramble, but I think that's where it comes from is that I didn't have parents who were young and sort of living this carefree, like, oh, let's just spend money. I mean, I remember my mom when I was like 8 back in the day, Jordache was a really big jean brand.
I remember.
And I remember my mom saying I absolutely could not have a pair of Jordache jeans because they were $16 and we were not going to spend $16 on a pair of jeans. Like these are things I remember from, you know, growing up. On the same token, I had a great aunt and a grandmother who every holiday or every birthday, they were, you know, shoving $5 bills or $20 bills as a surprise in our cards. And so I don't know, there just always seemed to be enough. I think I just kind of adopted that mindset that you don't spend too much. I did some saving when I was younger and saved up for some things, but at the same time, things usually will work themselves out if you plan ahead and if you have the wherewithal to earn money or find a way to earn money or find a way to get the money or whatever, stuff will work out. So I think there was also a, like I said, an abundance mentality that everything would sort of get taken care of somehow.
So then when you got married, were you and your husband on the same page financially? I mean, you seem to be really harmonious now. How have you learned to navigate the money talks together?
I think we are. I think some disagreements in terms of spending, but my background was that I was actually engaged before and broke off my engagement 4 months before my wedding and to a lovely man. Like it was just one of those things. But that was actually when I was in my credit card debt. One of the things that factored into why it was such a brave decision for me is my credit card debt was going to get wiped out if we got married. You know, obviously he was going to help pay my credit card debt and I right. still walked away from that. And now he has a very, very, very successful business. But back when you were dating, he was, you know, living off crackers and peanut butter and starting his business and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, but that said, I think I made a decision then that I was going to be responsible for my own financial future. And what happened after that engagement broke off was the next corporate job that I'd gotten after that, I met with the, you know, the folks that they bring in to talk to you about your 401k. And I was like, hey guys, this is my situation. I was engaged. I was supposed to get married. This was not supposed to be an issue for me. It is now. We need to plan. And I made a decision to put like a financial plan in place to save. So my husband is very similar to that. He's not overly spendy and he's also not, you know, tight with his money. But we agree that, you know, when you want to splurge on something, you splurge on something and then you save somewhere else. So we're both in alignment about that. And I don't know if that's just a happy accident or not. But, you know, the times that we have had a little bit of issue has been when one of us, usually me, wants to sort of go on a budget. Or he wants to go on a budget and I don't want to go on a budget. Like we have some issues there that we navigate. But I think our spending patterns and our view on money is very similar.
Great. And when you think about your financial future, what's your vision? What do you see?
For me, I just want to be safe. I think fear of not having enough is what drives me because I've seen, again, my dad is still alive and he's 88 and he's been retired since he was 65. So, you know, what is that? 23 years of having to live off retirement income. You know, I see it happen. And for me, it's just about wanting to make sure that we have enough money to be safe and comfortable and also splurge a little and do some of the things that we want to do. You know, if we're lucky enough to be healthy and be able to travel, I just don't want to have to worry, you know, and that's a different amount for everybody. But for us, it's maybe even just a little bit less than we're making right now would still keep us comfortable. And that's kind of how we look at it.
And what we envision for ourselves always leads to inspired action. You have that picture that you wake up into in the morning and that leads to inspired action. What are some of the actions you've taken to move yourself forward?
Well, we got a really good financial planner.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
So that's part of it. And number two, we're working on, because now we have a son who's 2 and we're working on making sure we have enough money for his college education as well as our retirement. So now our big action is we we've got to get a handle on where our money's going so that we know if we've got enough money to up our contributions to both his college fund and our retirement fund. So that's an action we're in the middle of taking right now, as you know.
Didn't you own investment real estate at one point?
We did. So we had a house in Seattle. And when we moved back to the Bay Area, we still had the house and we were renting it. And then in my infinite real estate wisdom, as soon as I had the baby in 2014, I was like, we have to sell the house. I don't want to have to worry about it. I don't want to have to worry about it. So we kindly asked our really, really awesome tenants to leave, sold the house. We were lucky enough to sell it for what we paid for it. And had we waited a year, we would have made a profit, but we didn't. So we were going to sell it when we moved, but we were having to undercut the price so low that it didn't make sense. So we ended up keeping it for, I think, about 2 years and renting it out. And every month I was worried about that. Even though we had the best, seriously, the best tenants in the world, it was just like this weight on my shoulders to just have to worry about that. Now it's funny because now we're like, you know, thinking about future investments. And we're like, oh, maybe we'll get a rental property. And I'm like, oh, you know, we had that and we sold it.
We tried that. That's interesting. I actually don't recall or didn't know that it worried you so much. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it was just one of those things where it's like just another variable, you know, and I think it was because I was just about to have a baby. It was just another variable. Like, what if something happens? What if they stop paying their rent and we don't have the money to cover that mortgage? What if they leave and we get tenants that are horrible? What if like the roof caves in? You know, all that kind of stuff was always hanging over my head.
Yeah. Other inspired actions that you've taken. So you always contributed to your 401k. Did you start the money conversations with your husband during your courtship and your engagement?
You know, honestly, I don't know that we did. I think we did talk about the fact that we wanted to have a joint checking account. You know, we personally didn't want to keep our finances separate. At that time, I was making more money than my husband, which kind of flipped when I started my own business. But at the time, I was making more and I was the one that had all the investment accounts. He didn't really have any investment accounts. So all those investment accounts are still in my name. And then we started some joint ones as well. And now the bulk of our retirement savings, even though I have a SEP with my own company, the bulk of the retirement contributions are coming from him now. So that's kind of flipped in our marriage as well.
How's that been?
You know, it's been fine. honestly, we're both fine with it. Like, he was very comfortable with me making more than him at one time.
And
yeah, actually, he totally was. I mean, if he could have his way, he would be a stay-at-home dad. So he's not threatened by that at all. And you know, part of it is he's a little bit younger than me as well. So I was further in my career than he was at that point. But yeah, I mean, honestly, it probably bothered me a little bit more than it bothered him.
Oh.
Yeah. Just because I come from a very traditional family and I was like, oh, okay. Just kind of riding on me now. Like, but I think
how unfeminist of you.
I know, which is so funny. But you know, but at the same time, I get really like annoyed if there's like a month that goes by that, you know, or whatever, that I'm not bringing in sort of my share of the household income. So there's also a competitive nature to me that's like, wait a minute, I need to make some more money here sometimes. But I think, you know, for me, the big catalyst was the broken engagement. And, you know, sometimes your life does not go as you plan. And even though that was one way to get rid of my credit card debt was to have someone else pay it off for me, that was not the way to go. And I'm actually really glad that was not the way to go. I mean, ultimately, you know, we slowly, I paid it down. And I remember that day I sent my last payment in and my husband was like, you are never keeping a balance on your credit cards again. I was like, you don't have to tell me twice. Like, it will not happen. And we're actually both on the same page. You were asking about that earlier. We are very both committed to when we get credit card bills, we pay them off every month. Mm-hmm. Like, do not want to hear that either of us have carried over a balance on our credit card bill.
Right. And a lot of people spend money to get the points and there's good reason to.
Well, and we do. Yeah. We put a lot on the credit card, but we pay it off every month. So
yeah. Are there any mistakes you've made that you'd be willing to share?
Personally or in my business?
Oh, financially.
Besides the $40,000 in credit card debt that I...
Well, yeah.
That was a mistake.
I think that, well, I know from the feedback I get on the show that it's empowering and inspiring for women to hear other women say, yeah, I blew it and I recovered. Like, it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So either way.
You know, and I blew it. I feel like I blew it for good reasons, but everybody says that, you know, it's like there was a period where I was overspending and then I had a job. And so it was okay. And then I was overspending and then I was laid off and then it was less okay. And then when I was laid off for like 4 months, you know, I was like, okay, either I get money from my parents or I just have faith that the tech industry is going to come back and I'm going to get a job and I'm just going to put this on my credit card for now and I'm going to worry about paying it off later.
I'm swinging on a vine here, people.
Let's go. Yeah. No, I don't know. I mean, in my business, I've made quite a few financial mistakes. One was not charging enough on projects to cover a good margin. So I had a project that lasted 7 months that I made a lot of money on for my subcontractors.
Oh.
Yeah. I didn't estimate the hours enough to cover my effort. And that was purely just ignorance. Like, I just didn't think about calculating my labor cost and calculating my time. I thought that my markup of my subcontractor's time was going to be enough to cover me. And I had a lot of subcontractors on that project.
So
and
you basically worked for 7 months for free.
Not quite for free, but if you look at what the profit was to my bottom line from that project versus what my subcontractors made, you know, making in the tens of thousands of dollars on that project. Yeah, it was a good lesson in you really need to estimate. You need to factor in your time as a separate line item when you're estimating projects. But
Maria, way to wrap it up with not only a transparent mistake shared, but also a critical business lesson.
Yes. Calculate your labor costs.
Bill for thy time.
Yes. Bill for your time.
Okay, fantastic. How can people find out more about you?
I would love if they would come visit me at red-slice.com and sign up for my email tribe, Red Slice Nation, which I weekly, if not every other week, offer insights and inspiration on branding, storytelling, messaging, entrepreneurship, wine, any nature of interesting topics.
And sometimes just your own funny opinions.
Exactly. I saw something one time that described Amy Schumer, comedian Amy Schumer, as a commentarian. And I was like, that's what I want to be. I want to be a commentarian. So yeah, maybe that's what my email list is. But yeah, no, I really try to provide value for people that are in business for themselves or run a business or they're trying to build a platform or rally a cause, anything where you really need to get your message out to the world.
And real quick, why is it Red Slice?
It is Red Slice because I had a personal blog before my business where I wrote about food and wine and art and theater that I called Red Slice because I have red hair and it was one slice of my many, many passions. And I decided to make that my company name so that I didn't have to be Ross Consulting.
There you go, folks. Red-slice.com. If you forget because you're on the freeway doing dishes or in the subway, you can find it at HillaryHendershot.com/30 in the episode show notes, along with links to many of the other interesting things Maria and I talked about today. Maria, you are excellent to interview. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
If you liked this episode, I'm inviting you to join us today in the free private Profit Boss community on Facebook. You don't have to know a super secret password or handshake, but you will benefit from a warm, encouraging, and confidential community who are all there to grow and learn from each other. It's an awesome opportunity to create a classroom out of what you learn here on Profit Boss Radio and in life and get feedback from how others in the Profit Boss community are achieving financial independence. Some of the really valuable discussions we've had recently in the Facebook group are how to make sure tax time goes super smoothly for you with no stress, what tools people are using to track their spending and make sure they're achieving their financial goals, and also what resources people are using to master their money mind. So plug in and take advantage of the collective wisdom from your fellow profit bosses. Crowdsource the answers to your most important financial questions in a confidential and supportive environment. Just go to HillaryHendershot.com/ProfitBoss. That's HillaryHendershot.com/ProfitBoss. And that link redirects you to a Facebook group. Just request membership and we'll let you right in. It's free. It's cool. It's awesome. It's supportive. We'll see you there.
Thank you for listening to Profit Boss Radio, where creating success on our own terms happens every day. You're not alone in your journey to a rich life, and that's why Hillary is here to add value in each and every episode. See you next time on the podcast for women and money.